Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Scottish historian Ian McInnes joins me to talk about John's sojourn at White Tree. Hey, if you want to read a real book, I mean like a real book, like a macho book, like a grown-ass adult history book, a book that's going to put hair in your chest. Scotland's Second War of Independence, 1332 to 1357, by Ian McInnes. It'll take a little scratch to buy that one, but boy, oh boy, will you impress your friends. Okay. After my conversation with Ian, I include a conversation I had with a fellow that I struck up a conversation with on email with last week, Gerard. Gerard and I talk a little bit about race in House of the Dragon. All right, without further ado, here is historian Ian McInnes. Ian, we're talking about a John chapter today. I don't know if you and I, have we talked about a John chapter before, you and I?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, this is a little bit interesting to me because in many ways, you know, the wall is modeled after Hadrian's Wall. In that analogy, the wildlings would be analogous to the Scots at the Picts at a particular period of time, or some kind of combination of, you know, the rumors about you wild folk up north. and I'm wondering if you see Martin drawing from some of those, that sort of that ancient polemic against the Scots by English folk.
I think in the medieval period, certainly in the earlier medieval period, that there is a feeling amongst the English, or certainly one given voice by English writers, English chroniclers, that, you know, the Scots are less civilized, that they're more barbarous. There's an interesting mix after the Norman conquest, because while Scotland doesn't go through a Norman conquest, you know, its kings are increasingly influenced by Norman ideas. You know, their future kings are raised as princes at the English court sometimes. And the nobility, the Scottish nobility, is increasingly one that is either Norman or continental, because they've been brought in by the Scottish crown to settle. So there is then a disparity between the crown and the nobility, and then the rest of the Scots. And even English chroniclers actually caught onto that difference. They see the kings and the nobles as being like us, but the rest of the Scottish people are still pretty wild and still pretty barbarous, because they have memories of Scots in the previous century, like in the 11th century, even still descending on Northern England to take slaves and things from amongst the English population. So I suppose with some justification.
Now, of course, I think, you know, there's always sort of gradations of what is North, right? Depending on where you are. I was just reading in a Dany chapter, Jorah's a tragic story of him marrying a Southern woman, and when she comes to Bear Island and sees, you know, what it means to be a lord in Bear Island, she just feels like she's gone camping. He basically just has a big old lodge, and, you know, there's no fancy cooks or singers at court or anything like that. And so there's a major disparity between what it means to be a lord up north and a lord down south. And I'm wondering if in the early medieval period, there would have been a big difference between, let's say, you know, some of the castle work in the south of England and, you know, France and Spain and whatnot, and the kinds of big halls that you might find up north.
Yeah, I mean, I think castle building comes to Scotland by degrees, I suppose. And again, that kind of Norman influence that starts to spread over parts of the kingdom. But yes, the early types of kind of Morton Bailey style construction, that Norman influence would again have been largely in with wood rather than with stone. And then there's a transition to stone from, say, the late 12th or into the 13th century onwards. But yes, perhaps running a bit behind norms in England or on the continent. But I suppose it's not just an early medieval thing either. We know from like the 14th century when French troops come to Scotland at various times, they find Scotland inveterably poor, and they're not all that keen to perform military service in Scotland because they just see it as a bit of a hole. And there's a comment by the Low Countries chronicler, Jean Froissart, when he says that the English could destroy Scottish homes, Scottish villages, but it only took them like 3 days to rebuild them, and it basically saying that Scottish house construction is so rubbish that it's easy to throw up a replacement. So, damning with faint praise. So I think even in the 14th century, the French people and people on the continent don't think much of Scotland. So yeah, it's not just an early thing.
So in this chapter, the Night's Watch is ranging north, and they come upon this village, white tree, and it's just a few, it's not. I mean, even the word village might be a little bit,
Four houses.
It's a little bit. Yeah, it's like four houses surrounding a giant tree, and yet because it is in, this tundra where there's nothing for miles around, it's mentioned on, these ancient maps that Sam has found. But my sense is that it very well could be that particular spot is important not for the population that surrounds it, but because it's something of a sacred place. Because it's the largest weirwood tree anyone's ever seen. And so I'm wondering if I do think that Martin has modeled a bit of the northern religion after his perception of Druidism, which is sort of a modern view of ancient people. But I think that there might be something there.
It is interesting that you have that, that's remarked upon, that him, John and Mormont are talking about the tree, and John's talking about its power and things. But yeah, if you might also expect then that if that's what attracted the village to be established round about it, that it might be bigger. Although I suppose it then just speaks to the fact that the wildling society is not like society south of the wall, is it? It works, it operates differently. So it's, yeah, I think it maybe is just to emphasize that you are beyond the wall, you're beyond normal civilized society, and so everything is different. Nothing is as you expect it to be.
There's this little line here that I'll go ahead and read the my synopsis of the chapter, and we can get it more into it. So Mormont's company of 200 sojourn at White Tree. This is the fourth empty settlement that they've encountered, but they remain ignorant about the doings of the wildlings. John scouts one of the empty buildings with Ed and then discusses the ranging with Sam, not for the first or last time. John's thoughts turn to the whereabouts of his uncle. Ian McGinnis, I'm wondering if anything had occurred to you in this chapter that we might talk about.
I thought one of the things that kind of came to me was just the nature of campaigning. I know it's a small force, or smallish force, it's a couple of hundred, but just that idea of it being quite a kind of grim thing
Would
to be
that have been
taking
a
part in.
small force, 200 men?
Well, I suppose I saw it as being, I mean, it's not an army, not in terms of a proper size thing. I mean, it probably is the size of a kind of smaller raiding force, yeah. Although a raiding force would probably not have traveled with the baggage that they seem to take with them, obviously with the crows and things, that would slow a force down. Raiding forces tend to be fast moving, so they don't take anything that they don't need. So it's, yeah, it's a kind of, I don't know what you would call it.
Well, Mormont seems to think, when he connects with Corrin Halfhand, who's got 100 men with him, that they'll have 300, and at that point they'll be a very formidable force. And it could just be that 300 men, given their enemy, is significant, right?
Well, I think that perhaps, yeah, I agree. I think it speaks to the fact that, yeah, they don't expect very much of the wildlings. Although it is a bit contradictory, isn't it? The wall's there to keep the wildlings out, or that's what they always say. But then obviously they assume that because they are better armed, better armored, that they can face off against a larger wildling force. That's not to be concerned about. I mean, I suppose the other thing is that 300 men is probably about as much as the watch can actually muster as far as a force these days, because it's so depleted. It might be a rather, it might be a more negative perspective of this is all they've got.
And I think that the perception here is that the wildlings are, you know, they're so fractured into clans that you might encounter a force of 50 men here and there, but they're never going to unite in a way that would ever be a problem. And I guess in addition to that, Mormont's got 100 horses, so that's certainly an advantage that the wildlings wouldn't have.
But I mean, I thought it was just interesting the way, you know, it seems like a pretty grim encounter. Obviously, the venturing further north, so it gets colder, it's snowier. But just a kind of unpleasant experience, you know, camping under the stars, having to go off into a bush to go to the toilet, you know, eating off whatever scraps they've taken with them, and that description by John of that kind of jovialness that you have when they set out has quickly gone by the by, and they're now all ratty with each other, and fear is rising, apart from with Sam, and that you know, all, this kind of pall descends on the force, which I think is nice. Again, it's the reality bumping up against the kind of chivalric expectation of things, perhaps at the start.
Right, I think that there's a romance to the adventure, right? It's like, we're going to range north and we're going to do heroic things, and this is where men can show their gallantry and whatnot. In reality, they're just stiff because they would love a bed to sleep on just one night,
Yes, it was the Dolorous Ed said he'd like to sleep in that patch of straw on the floor. Yeah, Sam does make the comment that he'd like to sleep under a roof. Yeah, no, absolutely. And it is just the practicalities of this. I mean, it must have been that kind of thing must have been quite grim. And of course, if you're part of a medieval campaign army, then if you're of a lordly status or whatever, you may have had your tents with you and things. It rather depends on the nature of things. But no, I suppose sleeping outside was still a possibility, depending on the nature of the campaign.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
I thought Ed was delightful in this chapter.
Yes.
He's just he's like a joke a minute, and of course it's all done by complaint.
I love that line of I grew up in a house like this, and then I fell on hard times. It's just like, really.
Well, it does. It kind of reminds you that we all feel sorry for Jon Snow, right? And for good reason. But the reality was, this really does show a contrast between John's upbringing and someone like Ed, who's like,
yeah.
This is, if it's softer than the ground and there's a roof over it, I call it a bed.
Yeah.
He has these really funny complaints about Mormont wanting to speak to the dead. He's like, I doubt the dead would even tell you the truth. They're probably liars in life, and they're liars in death, and they probably just complain about, my neighbor's plot is better than my plot. It's really funny. And I think we hear the name Dolorous for the first time.
Yeah, yeah. But it's quite interesting that Martin makes that a kind of funny thing as well, just because, obviously the Night's Watch have seen the dead.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd think it was not quite the kind of thing to make light of. You would expect if they hadn't.
It was like gallows humor, I suppose.
Well, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah. I do think that title, Dolorous, and this is just my own little theory, but I think it's an homage in reverse to Merry from the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Because of course John has a lot in common with Frodo, and
yep.
He's already got a friend named Pip, which Pippin, and then of course he's got a friend named Gren, and you put Pip and Gren together, you got Peregrine, which is the name, Pippin's real name. And so then where's Merry? You look around. Well, of course, in Martin's world, no one's Merry. Rather, you've got Dolorous Ed, and I think so. I think that you've almost have a sort of an ironic homage to this Hobbit there and back again story. So I don't know. I think at times Martin will do that. He'll throw a little nod to Tolkien, although well disguised. You saw some parallels to Jean Lebel?
Yeah, so there's a chronicler from Ainu in the Low Countries called Jean Lebel, who writes a chronicle in the mid 14th century, and he has experience in his younger days of being on campaign with English forces in Northern England in 1327 on the Weardale campaign, and it's an English army is raised to confront the Scots who have raided into Northern England. And Lebel gives this account of him and his fellow continental troops as part of this army wandering about Northern England in the rain and kind of wandering around from one village to the next, following the plumes of smoke left behind by the Scots who are setting fire to everything, but never coming in contact with the Scots. And also the Hainaulters don't get on particularly well with the English. There's fighting between the Allied troops, and it's all just a bit grim and a bit unhappy. And it just kind of reminded me of that, just that very practical soldier's eye view of a campaign, which is so far removed from any kind of notions of chivalry or kind of chivalric niceties.
Right. Now, this is sort of told as sort of a travel narrative, or is it like a journal, or how is it framed?
It's a kind of reminiscence, I suppose. He's describing the events of the year and is able to call upon his own recollections just in terms of having taken part in that particular campaign. And he expands it to the campaign at large. But yeah, it's just that he does bring in a lot of interesting detail, including about the Scots, because I mean, going back to the theme we were discussing before about Scottish savagery, you know, he describes how the Scots are very effective at war because they don't take any baggage with them. They take food on the go. They have a little pouch of oatmeal which they store under their horse's saddle. and they have an iron plate which they take with them, and then of an evening they sit down, they make a fire, they use the oatmeal and some water and make like a paste or a pancake type thing, and they kind of live off that. They live off raw flesh and river water. There's all the kind of stuff that your continentals and your English knights wouldn't have been able to deal with, but the Scots are. So there's that view of the Scots being hardy and thus it making them good at warfare, but also still that kind of negative element of, my God, they live like animals, but it makes them effective. So yeah, it's a really nice just kind of small account of that campaign. But yeah, as I said, it also smacks of just being quite grim. You can imagine them trudging around Northern England in the rain and never coming to blows with the enemy because the enemy won't let
right.
them.
And then in this chapter, of course, you've got that, you know, the village is empty, but there's kind of a smoldering or just a pile of ash with some skulls in there, and you imagine like something happened in this village. And then of course this story you're talking about, you blame it on the Scots who were like ravaging the countryside. You know, we see something like that going on down south with Tywin's forces from time to time. In fact, Arya has just, you know, encountered empty villages where she's, you know, she's trekking through a worn, torn village. In this case, we get the sense that the Night's Watch doesn't really understand why all these villages have been deserted. And it's almost a little bit more, spooky.
Yeah, I think Martin's being deliberately, you know, he's ramping up the mystery, mm-hmm. I suppose, and because... Because yeah, I mean, he refers to at one point as saying that, you know, the wood is even more haunted than usual kind of thing, and it is playing again because of the recent experience of the dead, it's very much playing up to that. But of course, you know, the villagers probably haven't been taken by the dead; they've gone off to form part of that, you know, larger grouping under Mans, haven't they?
So we were talking a little bit before about sort of Martin's interest in Druidism. And I thought I would read this little section. They're looking at this massive weirwood tree, and John says, My lord father believed that no man could tell a lie in front of a heart tree. The old gods know when men are lying. My father believed the same, said the old bear. Let me have a look at that skull. So it's like a throwaway line, right? But I do think that there is a... Etymologically, I think that there is a connection between sort of tree and truth in Old Saxon.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that there is something about the devotion to the oak that the Druids believed was connected to a man's truth. Right. And so Druids were kind of known as someone who you know, people of who spoke true, and you've got these old stories like Thomas the Rhymer, who like goes into an oak and encounters like the queen of fairyland, and she comes he's given a tongue that will not lie when he comes out. So there's these connections to the at least these old stories that suggest that there's a some kind of connection between the practice of Druidism and the truth. And I'm wondering if John's reference to his father kind of tells us a little bit something about sort of Ned's religion and Ned's character. You know, famously, Ned is so such a hardliner with when it comes to speaking honesty. And of course he lies a few times down south, but he's not nearly as good of a liar as someone like Littlefinger. And I think that there might be something about his connection to the religion of the North that really makes him ill-equipped for Southern politics. I just thought that little line was an interesting suggestion about the religion of the North.
I suppose it also ties into that, you know, the fact that the wildlings, you know, if you extend that, I suppose, in religious terms, the wildlings and the northerners aren't actually that different, you know, yeah. because of their attachment or potential attachment to the old gods. They haven't gone the way of the South, which, you know, with its newfangled ideas of the seven and things. And you know, it is that determination to stick to the old ways of doing things. I suppose I thought as well, the whole idea of truth and things, I was thinking as well of, you know, medieval oaths, you know, that if you swear an oath in the Bible, or something similar, but you're swearing it before God, and so you again can't or at least shouldn't lie or break that. And I suppose I saw that kind of similarly to what.
Well, yeah, and the knights, the tradition, the old tradition of the Night's Watch is to swear your vow to the order in front of the heart tree. Which John does, and of course I think that is meant to create something of a religious veneer to the institution of the Night's Watch. I don't know, it's an interesting little bit. Now, I don't know how much Martin is aware of histories of Druidism, because I think in many cases we're just dealing with oral history. Of the Druids, but of course you've got modern day Druids who seem to, you know, at least in lip service, draw from ancient traditions. So I don't know how much of this is sort of a modern look at the Druids, or, you know, sort of an homage, you know, a wink and a nod to the Druids or something like that.
I suppose there's also the link to the kind of culture around death as well, which you know, in pre-Christian societies, you know, would have been at times, you know, the burning of the body, which of course then is extended as John suspects, because, you know, you don't want to leave any bodies behind because then they might come
back.
Yeah. But which also ties into that kind of pre-Christian view of cremation as opposed to
burial. That's right. Notable introductions in this chapter. We have quite a few. We have Bedwick, who they call Giant. We hear Ed's nickname for the first time. We're introduced to White Tree. We meet Jarman Buckwell and Otten Withers. So I don't know how he comes up with these names. I think he said sometimes he just opens up old books and looks at what people's names were back then. But on occasion, he will invent a name. Like the other day, I was reading a chapter where he, you know, one of the lords in the chapter was Axel Florent, which I think is an homage to Axel Rose. So I think I do think that he's not always faithful in naming these. Sometimes these names are quite modern. And keeping up with my practice of documenting all of the words of Mormon's bird, he says old three times. He says gone four times. He says corn once. And he says snow. No, he doesn't say snow. Sam is teaching the other birds to say snow. And interesting throwaway line here. I thought it was maybe a bit of foreshadowing. We're told that in the North, or for Men of the Night's Watch, the word snow is synonymous with death. And, of course, I think, you know, knowing what happens to John, I think that we could, you know, we could infer that there is a little bit of foreshadowing here. Notable differences. None of this happens in the show.
No.
There's no White Tree. I think that the troop is much smaller. I think that in early on in the series, you know, just getting, you know, 10 horses together was kind of an expense that they were trying to avoid. You know, 200 troops and 100 horses is not within the budget.
Not going to happen. Yeah,
that's right.
No.
That's right.
And I think that there's a kind of hint of this chapter in their arrival at Crafton's.
Yeah, maybe camp. So. It's, right? Some of their hunger, some of their desperation in the campaign is portrayed in that. I also noted, and I kind of been... I'm a little bit persnickety when it comes to this, but when they are up north, it bothers me to no end that there's no hats or hoods on these actors.
Yeah. Hmm.
I just feel like if you're up in the snowy tundra, cover your head. You just
yeah.
And I noted in this chapter that Sam is wearing a hood, and I thought, that's smart, Sam. Way to go.
Yeah. but you have to make them visible or recognizable.
Well, and you've got,
for the viewing audience.
Kit Harington has such a beautiful head of hair. You don't want to cover it up.
Ah, yes. Aesthetic decisions were like.
Exactly. Ian, thank you so much for your time. I always learn a lot, and I always enjoy talking about this with you.
No, thanks very much. It's always fun, so that's why I keep doing it.
Hey, man, I appreciate it. What's your plan today?
No, I've got another hour of work, and then I have a run to go and do before the weekend.
Right.
But then it's cheat night tonight, so I get to after I have my run, I get to enjoy pizza. So
very good, fantastic.
Looking forward to that.
All right, man. Hey,
how about just you?
Oh, I've got a couple doctoral defenses that I'm doing later today.
Oh, right.
So I'm just gonna
The same day.
Two in the same day. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. It's a different kind of thing, and these are both done on Zoom.
Oh right. Yeah.
So you know, hang up with one person and then log on with another person, and much less of a. I guess when I got my PhD, it felt like I had run a marathon afterwards.
Yeah.
Like when I did my doctoral defense, it really did feel like I had barely crossed the finish line. I was just exhausted. And you know, both my internal and external world Cambridge guys that kind of felt like, you know, it's a rite of passage to make this guy feel like he's a complete failure. So, and then I left thinking like I can't believe I botched that. I'm walking away. I'm gonna walk away with an M-lit. This is a disaster. And then you know I walk back in the room and they're all smiles and congratulatory. Yeah. You know, it was this whole performative thing, and I just felt completely blindsided by the whole experience. I don't know if you had any kind of similar experience.
I was fortunate in that they said I essentially passed the thesis bit of it, but I still had to pass the viva part of it. So you know they essentially kind of said it was two separate things almost.
Oh, and they broke it up into two. Well, that puts a little bit less pressure for sure.
Yeah, so I felt a bit more confident then in the discussion that followed. But we still had a 2-hour discussion. Which was you know nerve wracking, but at least it wasn't. I didn't think the whole thing was on the line, and I wasn't sitting outside thinking I failed.
Yeah. Oh, geez. It was a trying moment. Did you feel like it was more of a celebration of your work or like an interrogation of your work?
I think it was more interrogatory, but not in a bad way. You know, it was you know, okay, let's go into more detail about this. So it was, you know, it was a nice academic discussion about some key themes and you know,
that's the
particularly
my
external.
That's the
absolutely. I sat on a thesis panel recently as the external examiner for the first time, so I got to experience that the other way around, and I did try as much as possible to make it like that because I think that's interesting. It's interesting for me, never mind for them.
The role of the external is almost supposed to be something of a devil's advocate, I think.
Yeah.
But you were like, I don't think I'm gonna be a hard ass.
Oh, no, no. I don't think I'm in any position to want to be, never mind anything else. No, I quite enjoyed it, and hopefully the student did too once they knew they passed. So that was the main thing.
All right, I'll let you go. I really appreciate it.
Magic, thanks, Anthony. Good speech again.
And now Throwback Thursday with comic Steve Osborne.
I've got a big problem with what's going on up north, Steve.
All right.
So we go back up north.
Are we talking north? The whole Theon is.
No. I mean the north of the wall, like beyond where the Fist of the First Men.
Mm-hmm.
And we meet a Quorn Halfhand. And I'm interested in that character. Like John really idolizes Quorn Halfhand. Quorn kind of looks like the prototypical ranger, and he's always wanted to be a ranger. And he can survive for a full winter beyond the wall. And so he's sort of this heroic character in John's eyes, right?
Right.
In reality, Steve, he's the only one wearing a hat.
Huh.
I've got a big problem with all of these people up north not wearing hats.
Yeah.
Of course they're going to die up north. They're not wearing hats.
Well, but that just shows why he is to be respected, right?
Yeah. Put on a hat.
It's a simple thing.
You can survive in the snow.
The only thing that separates him from everybody else is like.
You have Lord Mormont who's leading the whole crew. He's bald and he's not wearing a hat.
Yeah, it's like, they're like, is he a great soldier? No, but for some reason, like, well, everybody else is just chattering. He seems to be fine. Almost sweating even. He may be half hand, but he's full hat.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
As soon as I saw your email, I thought, oh no, I think this person knows more than I do.
I don't know about that, but... I
mean, you know, I present as kind of this scholarly person who knows things about Martin's world, and the reality is that I fake it pretty well, and I can do research, I know how to do research, but as soon as I saw your email, I thought... Okay, I'm definitely hazy on my Targaryen lineage content. So let's just, for people that want to know, just fill us in on the email that you sent me last week.
Yeah, so I sent Anthony an email about Aegon the Conqueror's mother, basically, and the Valyrians. And I think it's something that the showrunners may have missed or maybe just didn't pick up on or maybe just thought it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. And wanted to focus on some other things, but Fire and Blood is basically a history book, and I'm a history buff. I love it. I know a lot of people find it really dry, but I really love it. But I think that it gives the showrunners a lot of autonomy to kind of do whatever they want, because in Ice and Fire, there's a lot more details, right?
Right.
So Fire and Blood gives them a lot more to play with, and they decided to make the Valyrians black, and I think that they missed that Aegon the Conqueror's mother was also Valyrian. And in the email that I sent you, I put that Velena Valyrian should have been black, obviously, if the show canon is going to keep up with that. I did do a little bit more research, and I don't know why I didn't think about this, but in the beginning of Fire and Blood, they talk about Velena, and she's the first Valyrian that they bring up. She is actually half Targaryen, half Valyrian.
Okay.
But as you go forward in history, Jaehaerys, who is brought up at the beginning of Fire and Blood, his mother was Alyssa Valyrian. So she also would have been black, right?
Right.
So that means Jaehaerys would have been some percentage of black. I don't want to say exactly what. Don't know if my math is necessarily right and all of that. But he would have been close to 50% mm-hmm. black, maybe even mm-hmm. more than that. And that means that Viserys would have been part black. That means Rhaenyra would have been part black. And I think that when you're getting into the discussion of who her children's fathers are, you know, them being bastards, I think that would have been a lot more in question had they really followed the Targaryen lineage mm-hmm. and the Valyrian lineage.
So let's just explain that I think you and I are both on the same page, that we kind of like the idea of Steve Toussaint being cast in this role. Like, we're both pretty on board with the decision to bring more black actors into the show. Is that safe to say?
Yes, I love him. I think he's great. I think that it was the perfect choice. You know, as a black gay man, I'm totally for it.
Okay, all right. And I'm for it for a couple of reasons. And one of the reasons is just that I think it's really... it really adds something to the show to make it so freaking obvious. These are not Lenore's children, you know. These are clearly not Lenore's children. So I like that decision. Now, I think that there's a couple ways that I could get at this argument if you are willing for a little bit of pushback.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let me push back a little bit there. I think there are two answers to your question. And so before I give you my answers, let me just restate what I hear you saying first. The Targaryens and the Valyrians have a long history of intermarriage. You know, going back to Aegon's, at least Aegon's mother, and probably long before that, you know, in old Valyria. And so if they are intermarrying, then they're basically going to have the same complexion, the same eye color and things like that. And and maybe the showrunners have overlooked this. Famously, Aegon the Conqueror's mother is Valyrian. I think that's what you said in your email. Is that right?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. All right. Okay, I'll give you the what I think is the right answer, and then I'll give you what I think is the nerdy answer, okay?
Okay.
All right. Here's the right answer. The right answer in my mind is the showrunners are not beholden to book canon, and so they kind of have free range to do whatever they want and to make changes wherever they want because that's just their prerogative. What do you think about this?
To an extent, I agree, right? You know, maybe the showrunners, you know, they decided to go a different direction with things. But I think if they want to do that, then they have to answer that question somewhere along the line, right?
Yeah.
So maybe after that, we get through, you know, the Dance of Dragons, they decide to go back and do, you know, Aegon the Conqueror's story and give us a little bit more backstory. And who knows, maybe, you know, maybe her father, you know, was more white in complexion, or, you know, maybe there's something there that we don't know. And there could be, you know, there's always these hidden gems in George R. R. Martin's writing. We always find out a lot of different things later. And in, in the show, we found out some interesting things with the dagger and the story of, you know, A Song of Ice and Fire and Aegon having that dream. So I definitely think that there could be the showrunners kind of taking things in a different direction and playing with things. But I think that, they have to answer that at some point in time.
So it's interesting. So I would, you know, I'm just in A Clash of Kings right now, and I'm thinking about Sansa's narrative, and I'm thinking, like, in the show, what they do is they basically marry Sansa off to Ramsay Snow, and that does not happen in the books. And there's no explanation. It's just that the showrunners decided, we're going to conflate two characters here. We're not going to do a fake Arya plot. We're not going to do any of that business. We, for the purpose of this new genre, we just have to tell a different story. And as viewers, we kind of just go along for the ride. I think that for adaptations, you kind of expect these kinds of things. And I'm okay with it. So I don't know if they'll ever have to kind of explain it for me to feel good about it.
But I think that there has to be a little bit of, things have to line up and add up together, right? Like, we all, well, I shouldn't say we all, but, you know, I've been watching Star Trek. My grandparents watched Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been a part of my family for a really long time.
Yeah, me too.
And there's definitely some different things going on in all the different series that they have, and all the different shows that they have, but things still primarily line up, and even now we're getting explanations of things in the past, I think, to explain things and why they ended up the way that they are. And I think that if George R. R. Martin is at the helm of this, and he still is, right, like he still has some control over this, and he can tell them, no, I don't want you guys to use my content or whatever, I think that things still have to line up somewhat. And let's say that in the future someone else does want to create a show, I think it would be really confusing and could lead to major issues if all of a sudden the Targaryens are mixed race, right? You know, and people are going to be really confused about that.
Okay, so I like this. I love that we're bringing up Star Trek here. All right. Are you a Worf fan? A Next Generation Worf fan? Do you like the character Worf?
I can't go that far into it, but yeah. I mean,
the character Worf is famously played by a black actor who has this giant prosthetic on his forehead.
Yeah.
And then you go back and you're looking at the way that the Klingons look in the original series. They do not look like Worf at all. And you know, every now and again, there's kind of a nod to the shift or whatever. And I'll be honest, it's a little disappointing to me that there isn't a little bit more continuity, but I kind of have come to expect it. But all right, so I gave you my what I think is the right answer, but let me give you what I think is the nerdy answer, okay? Are you ready for this?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. Okay, here we go. Here's a really nerdy answer, okay? So Corlys Velaryon famously portrayed by Steve Toussaint. His mother is named Vaya or Viella. I'm not sure how to say that name right, but
yeah.
Okay, Viella is the daughter of Daeron Targaryen, and her mother is Tyrashi. Okay. Her mother is a woman named Kiera of Tyrosh, which means that there is some intermarriage with sort of like some other tribe of Essos with Corlys Velaryon's grandmother. So it's possible that the Velaryons are white as white for a long time, going back to, you know, before the Doom. And then at the generation of Corlys's grandmother, we have some influx of Tyrashi influence into the genetics. And maybe that's when the new phenotypes come into play. So that would be my super nerdy answer. It's like, maybe we don't really know what Kiera of Tyrosh looked like. Maybe that's the answer.
Yeah, that could be it. You know, going back to kind of Velina, like I was saying, we don't really know exactly, you know, what her father would have looked like, you know, and same also with her mother. Right. So that could be the answer. That could be where they're stemming it from. Mm-hmm. But I think that, I guess they don't really necessarily have to answer the question per se, because there's a lot of people that just watch the show to watch the show.
Right.
But maybe it's George R. R. Martin's problem to answer somewhere in all of his books that he is writing. Or maybe not. Maybe it's just like, you know, he's decided to go one direction, and maybe, you know, the shows are going to go their direction.
Yeah. So I think, just to reiterate, I don't think that this is, I think that you're going to find other people who are online who know this far better than I do, and they're going to say, you know, Kiera of Tyrosh doesn't solve the problem. And I would say, yeah, that was sort of my attempt to create some wiggle room. At the end of the day, the nerdy answer is not the right answer. I think the right answer is adaptation. Showrunners make choices. They are not beholden to the canon. And you and I, of course, might yearn for continuity, but we sometimes we don't get it. I think that that's just part of being a fan of a show that's based on a book but isn't always faithful to the book.
Yeah, but I also think it's also part of the times that we live in, the world that we live in, right, too, that, you know, the Targaryens happen to be white and they want to continue to push that and peddle that, whereas, you know, maybe if the show came out of a different place in the world, it may have not necessarily
been that way. No, I totally get that. Dude, I really appreciate the conversation. Thank you so much for making the time for it.
Of course. It was great to be here. Thanks for having me.